Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
All right. We'll turn our attention to some baseball now. The opening weekend was a good one for the Mets. I was kidding, but actually, the Yankee fans are annoyed already. Stanton's already on the DL. Not the DL anymore. The IL.
Yes.
Now, the 10-day list. The book is 108 stitches. Ron Darling with Daniel Paisner, who I do not know. Publisher of St. Martin's Press. This is not Ronnie's first book, of course. He wrote the book about Game 7, 1986. So he's back with another book. The very talented broadcaster, Ron, welcome. How are you?
Good, Mike. It's great to be here.
How's the start of your baseball season?
Well, the start, I mean, remember last year I did a start too. It was 11-1. Everyone's happy when things are good. You hit your first bad part. That's when you really see what kind of team you have. But
Tell the Mets fans, what do you think of this team?
You know what? I really like this team in this way, is that, yes, they have some older players. Cano can still play, by the
way. Yes, he can.
He can still play. But they got some, they're getting a little, I don't know if it's luck. It's not luck, right? But they're getting a break now where it looks like the players they bring up,
Alonso
can, really
can
play.
Alonso can hit.
McNeil
can rake. He can hit. I don't know if he can feel, but he can hit.
Exactly. Yeah. So at least you're seeing some a young exuberance, some young emotion, young talent to combine with kind of the old guard. So that to me is, I think, exciting to go along with their fine pitching.
Yeah, they definitely, and they do have fine pitching. And yesterday, at least they mounted a little comeback. You know, they need another right-handed bat in the outfield for sure. I mean, I don't know if Broxton or Legarius is going to give them anything offensively, but if they get one more bat offensively, or Alonso is going to be a big hit, because I think the catcher will hit, and you know Cano will hit, Conforto will hit.
Yeah.
It looks like McNeil will hit. So you got enough there to put it together. Nimmo will be good enough. I don't know. At least he'll walk a lot. I don't know how much he'll hit. But the bottom line is they need one more righty guy that can hit.
I don't disagree with you. I think
Davis hits. I don't know if he'll hit.
Maybe. But you looked at that lineup yesterday, and the lineup yesterday was not the same lineup against the left-hander Corbin that it was the first two games. So you're going to Mickey and the powers that be are going to have to find some way, or with the guys that they have on that team, to deliver. Maybe Broxton and Legarius have to play in the outfield at the same time against lefties, and hopefully that'll work. Who knows?
But I'll tell you this, to be fair, they don't have guys that look like Soto. They don't have guys that look like Turner. Those guys are better-looking players than the Mets have. Their young players look like a different class. Soto looks like a different class player. He just looks like he's better.
Yeah. Trey Turner is a very underappreciated player.
Very good player.
He's a very good player.
Yes. And Soto's scary-looking.
You know, Soto reminds me, now he's a different player, but because of his plate discipline at such a young age, he reminds me of a young Bobby Abreu.
Wow.
In the way that he's got some pop and he can do some things. Bobby, of course, was a great a base runner, too. And then this kid, Robles, you saw everything under the sun with him.
Yes.
I mean, you saw mistakes.
Terrible
you saw
bases,
raw
base
talent.
Running, right. Yep. Outfield mistakes.
So it's going to be interesting to see how he grows during the year.
Yeah, and they're pitching. They got good frontline pitching, too. Major. I don't know about their bullpen, but they got frontline pitching.
They do. Their bullpen had a hard time of it, though.
Yeah, definitely. All right. The book.
Yes.
Just came out, right?
Yeah.
It's coming out a couple weeks?
No, it's coming out tomorrow.
Oh, it's coming out tomorrow. Yeah. Just came out. Okay.
I was thinking the book industry, April Fool's Day is probably a bad day to come out with it.
Oh, so that's okay.
Maybe. I don't know.
Now, your second book, okay? Your first one was well received. Your theme on this one, I was just reading through it today when I was driving in.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you told, you know, for the guys I know, you told the story about Mickey and Willie and Billy in the restaurant.
Yeah.
I can't even think of you going over there because I have been in places with those guys.
Yes.
And they were rough. Let's be honest. You talked about it as being a young player. If you were pre-Mickey Betty Ford,
yes,
Mickey, Billy, and Whitey together, especially Willie and Mickey, they were tough because they get loaded, and they were surly. They were tough, those guys.
I did not look up at all. I walked
I
past
even
them
imagine.
And went.
You're
I was,
at a table with
I
Mickey. Always had, they wake you. They pull you over to their table, right?
I always had a table in the back, and that's where I sat. The owner of the establishment was a guy named Jerry Casale. He had been a pitcher for the Red Sox, a kid from Brooklyn, and he knew those guys. That's why they were there. And
they could drink.
They had an unbelievable time, but I'll tell you.
See, they drank every day, those guys. That's
they,
why. They could drink.
They just didn't. You wouldn't have thought they had a drink.
Yeah. I mean, that's what just, I mean. It doesn't affect them. They just could drink all day.
It didn't affect them. And I just, but when they saddled me with the check, I just, you know, when I was that age, Mike, I don't know about you, but I had about $200 in the bank. And I said to myself, well, I could pay for this dinner, but I certainly won't be able to pay my rent this month.
That's pretty funny. You know that? And they weren't used to putting it in their pocket for the drinks either. You know that? No.
They never paid for anything.
No. And, you know, it's funny. A couple of times we saw Mickey. Now, remember, Mickey Mantle to me was God, okay? Yeah. I mean, when I grew up,
of course.
He was God. So when I met Mickey Mantle the first time, I was scared to death. I was the only time all years I did this, the only time I was ever really intimidated. The first time we talked to the president,
yeah,
I was scared.
Wow.
It was Bill Clinton was president.
Okay.
And I was nervous because it was Bill Clinton. He was actually the president.
Of course.
Okay, he calls us. Okay, so, but the other time was Mickey. And the first time, Mickey invites Dog and myself to his restaurant, and he's doing a book signing. And
This is the one at Central Park South?
Yes. And he's at fifth. He invites us to come start our show at Mickey Mantle's, and he's at the bookstore on Fifth Avenue. 1,000 people online. 1,000 people. So when he comes there, he's already signed 1,000 books when he gets to us, and he's not in a good mood. And he starts to drink, and boy, he was rough.
Yeah.
And he came on here and did an interview with us, and he was half in a bag.
Jeez.
And it was, but then I interviewed him later on after he hadn't, when he wasn't drinking anymore, when he was, you know, past the Betty Ford
part.
He was
like a cuddly bear, wasn't
he? He's like the nicest guy in the world. It was like you felt so bad for him at that point, but he was a tiger when he was drinking.
He really was.
And Billy was always that way.
You know, I had spent a lot of time around Billy because I knew his driver. I'm trying to think of his name. Was it Tex or something like that? Was his driver. He used to drive him around. Plus, Billy, was in the Oakland area
at times.
in those days. So I know the only time I ever felt that way, because I'm a kid from Massachusetts and I'm 57 years old, is the first time I ever met Bobby Orr.
Okay.
Was the same way. And I just couldn't say anything, couldn't speak. And then anyone who's been around Bobby Orr
was like the sweetest, nicest guy in the world. I had him in here to do a book.
World.
I had never met him. And, you know, I watched him when he was, you know, we're like the same age, but he was like 17. He was already Bobby Orr.
I mean,
you know, he was God.
That's right.
New England, people, they grow up with, you know, he's God. And people don't realize in Boston, you know, Bobby Orr is, he's bigger than anybody. They worship him.
When they won their first Stanley Cup, he scored the game-winning goal where Barkley Plager kind of tripped him up as he scored past Gump Worsley. And all of us kids at 7, 8, 9 years old, that's how we would trip each other all ice hockey games long to just to try to recreate that great goal.
You know, it's funny. You talked about wanting to ask those guys about Kekich and Fritz Peterson, which is funny. You know that? Because I remember living, you know, as a kid living through that, hearing about that. And, you know, it's funny. You know, I wish they would have told you some wild stuff, because those guys, they probably had their own wild stories themselves. Because Mickey he was Mickey Mantle. I mean, he was handsome. He was Mickey Mantle.
Yeah,
I mean, you talked about Elster being a ladies' man. Imagine what Mickey was like.
Mickey was what every one young boy wanted to be. Right. That's who it was. And then, you know, the whole thing about this book, 108 Stitches, is that there's 108 stitches in a ball. Everything's connected. So I tried to connect all the people I know. And, of course, Mel Stottlemyre is connected.
What a great guy.
And Mike Kekich, the late, great Mel Stottlemyre.
Right, your pitching coach.
My pitching coach. And not only that, my father figure when I was a ball player.
And one of the nicest guys you ever met. And I could tell you this, because I lived those days. I came of age as he came to the Yankees in 64. I remember the 64 season and the 64 World Series like it was yesterday.
Yep.
And he came up as a rookie, and he became a huge figure. He pitched them to the pennant, 9-3 down the stretch.
That's right, 9 wins.
And pitched in great in the World Series, challenged Bob Gibson. And he then was their team through all those bad years.
That's
and
right.
People have no idea. He was so good on bad teams where he pitched great and lost game after game and never complained and pitched nine innings and would lose behind an error, or he pitched 40 shutouts in his career. He should have been a Hall of Famer. He was that good.
We used to kiddingly, when anyone said something disparaging or whatever, we'd say, check Mel Stottlemyre's back of his baseball card, because, you know, routinely 26 complete games, 28 complete games.
Unbelievable. And he lost 20 games, but you had to be good to lose 20 games because he pitched all the time.
But his whole thing is that, you know, today's world, he would have had that shoulder fixed and he would have been fine. And, you know, injuries in those days for starting pitchers
was a death warrant. He pitched great and he missed the eras. You know, he and Mattingly both missed the eras as great players. He would have been a legendary figure. He would have been a Hall of Famer for sure.
He would have.
And he was a great, look how good a pitching coach he was.
He was
two stints with you guys and then with the Yankees.
Amazing pitching coach. And I was thinking about, you know, one of the things that you forget about coaches is sometimes they have to give up what they'd really like to do to be your coach. And that entire time that he was mentoring Dwight Gooden and Sid Fernandez and all of us, his young sons were becoming really good pitchers.
Right.
And Mel Jr., who's now a pitching coach, was well on his way to being a star, hurt his arm. And his son Todd had a really solid major league career. But while they were learning the game, he was teaching it to us.
Which is amazing. And you guys, you know, it's funny. I always said this. There were great teams that should have won more. Your 86 team should have won more than one World Series. Now, you didn't have a wild card, which hurt.
Yes.
But you guys should have, and let's be honest, you were lucky to win you did because it was the worst managed World Series both ways of all time.
That's right.
Davey was terrible, and in the other dugout, he was worse.
Houston was a little lucky series, too.
Yeah, that was a great series, That was played real high. The Red Sox series was a mess.
But it could have went either way, though. I'm just saying.
The Red Sox series was a mess. But you tell a story in the book about Lenny, who I know very well. I can tell, you know, and you're not going to tell too many tales about Lenny, I know, but what he did to Oil Can Boyd was just unbelievable, right?
Well, yeah, well, you know, in those days, and if you read the whole paragraph, you know, Lenny had a way about him, and I know that...
Yeah, he was a psycho.
He was a little crazy, but I think what the paragraph was really trying to say, and you know, as I was writing this book, I'm writing it, you know, as the NFL is going through their thing, as the Kaepernick thing is going through their thing.
The world has changed. Right.
You know, what was said 33 years ago in a fraternity of young boys trying to play a sport, young men trying to play a sport, is that as you look back on it when you're 57 or 58 years old, you're kind of ashamed of the complicitness of yourself to these kind of things, because I will be brutally honest, you know, that listen to Lenny get on Oil Can Boyd, but as soon as Lenny hit that home run, which was the biggest hit we needed in the World Series, I was the first one to congratulate him.
But let's be honest, if Oil Can Boyd had a different temperament, if he was Bob Gibson, Lenny's got the first one in his ear.
Exactly. I think that in those days, people tried to rile each other in a lot of different ways. You hope it didn't happen that way. But
there was still bench jockeying in your. It's a foregone thing now. They don't do it anymore, right?
I don't think they do it to the extent it was done then.
It was still done in your era, right?
You tried to. There was intimidation on both sides, trying to, you know, say the loudest thing.
They
at the
knew
wrong
who had
time
rabbit
or
ears and who didn't, right?
Exactly, and I think that, you know, as you look back on it now, I'm a little embarrassed that it took place and that you were a part of it. But at the same time, when you're in the middle of this thing, you wish you were on the right side of history. Sometimes you're not.
Yeah,
so
but
that's
it just
what
shows how
meant.
Much the you mentioned it in yeah, there yeah. too. And Ronnie has a good point. Ronnie is mentions in here a couple of guys. If you remember Kevin Elster,
yeah,
good hitting, good fielding, shortstop, handsome kid from California,
great kid.
Ronnie ran with Billy Bean. Okay, from you know, Ronnie was also a very handsome player when he was young and still, you know, still a good looking guy. But you guys were single, you're running around, and it's a different world. Okay, you mentioned that. Now you're talking about what it's like in this generation where things have changed. But let's be honest, you guys as ball players, you know, were healthy young guys running around and going out.
Yeah, we were left unfettered. You'd be embarrassed by some of the behavior today, but it was 33, 35 years ago, and things have changed. And I think that's probably the difference in this book from the other two. I think the other two were more of a introspective look at kind of what I did. This one's kind of just a fun saloon book about things that I've seen. And some of them are probably too honest for some people, but honesty, I think, plays for people who are reading.
Did you ever think that Billy Beane would ever wind up being like, considering what the guy you knew? Because you were pretty close with Billy Beane, right?
Billy Beane was a tremendous guy, a tremendous athlete, maybe one of the best athletes I'd ever seen. There was no doubt in my mind that at some point he'd figure it out. But the hardest part about this sport, baseball, is that at some point you figure out how to hit or you don't. You know, you can either hit or you can't. And it never was Billy's time to do that. But the way he's transformed himself and taken all of his great talent and intelligence and turned into what he's done in Oakland. I mean, what they did last year in Oakland is just amazing. To get into that wild card game against the Yankees almost boggles the mind.
And, one other guy that you spent time with before we break, and we're talking with Ronnie Darling, the book is 108 Stitches with Daniel Paisner, and it's St. Martin Press. You also, more than brush paths, you spent a lot of time with Dave Duncan, who was probably the greatest pitching coach of all time. He was with Tony La Russa for 27 years. He transformed how many guys from journeymen into stars. Everyone could never figure out. I always said, if I had a team, I would go get a manager for $1 million and pay Dave Duncan 10 because Dave Duncan transformed the whole pitching staff. You could bring anybody in there. He figured out how to make them good. What was Dave Duncan's secret?
Well, one thing, if you ask Tony La Russa, he would never manage a team without Dave Duncan as a pitching coach.
He's smart.
What he did was he was one of the first pitching coaches to track every pitch, track where every pitch was hit, track how hard it was hit, and all of those things on what pitch you threw. So on your day of game, he wouldn't talk to you as much, although he would, but his catching staff, whoever was catching that day, had a blueprint from Dunk on how to get these hitters out. And what he
So he used the catcher to make you better.
Yes, and what he would do is that he knew your ability. He knew what you could and could not do. And I remember we had a conversation when I first came to Oakland, and he said, do you remember the pitcher in the 80s that you were? I said, yeah. He goes, well, you need to forget about that guy because he's gone. And the only way you're going to get people out is doing these three or four basic things. And I really hitched my wagon to his star, and it gave me 2.5, 3 more years of my career, because when I got there, I was just about done. And my first full year under him, I probably pitched some of the best games I ever pitched in the major leagues, and I won 15 games. I know wins don't count anymore. They counted then.
They still should count.
He was transformative in that way, and I'll owe him for giving me that one great last year.
One thing, because it's an interesting story, and he's been in the news lately, how about the way Tom Seaver befuddled Dave Duncan?
It's
a very interesting point in the book.
It's one of the best stories I've ever heard in baseball. And the gist of the story, very quickly, folks, is that Tom Seaver is on the White Sox pitching staff. Duncan's the pitching coach. He comes out and the bases are loaded, the left-handed hitter's up. It's two outs, and they think that Seaver's getting tired. Duncan comes out and asks him, are you all right? Can you get this last hitter out? And Seaver says, yes, absolutely. Duncan goes back to the bench. Seaver throws one pitch way out of the strike zone, high, ball one. Throws the next pitch way out of the strike zone, ball two. Next pitch, he throws a changeup. The left-handed hitter hits a ground ball to second base, 4-3. Gets to the bench, and Duncan sits next to Seaver, who now is done for the night, and kiddingly says, well, Tom, I wasn't sure. I came out of there. You went 2-0. Tom said, well, I had to. He said, well, what are you talking about? Well, I had to get to the changeup. The only way I can get there is throw two fastballs. And Dunk was like, I'm not worthy of this guy. I'm going to leave him alone.
He threw the two pitches out of the zone to set up the ball, and said, I knew we'd roll it to second.
That's
unbelievable.
That's crazy.
Seaver was as good as I've ever seen.
He was.
Day in and day out. That's really was.
He was even great at the end
unbelievable, huh? Even Dunk said he couldn't understand it, right?
That's the science of pitching.
Yeah, unbelievable. Back after this. All right, we're back. Ronnie Darling with us, the book, 108 Stitches. You know, Ronnie, when I see the game now, and this is, I've been, you played it. You were around it forever. I've been around it my whole life. Here's the part I don't like. And I understand we live in a world now and every sport's the same and people talk it. I see guys on TV now talking about war, you know, talking about wins above replacement, talking about stuff all the time, talking about possessions per 100 in the NCAA tournament games now. Here's what they do, possessions per 100, okay? You know, there's stuff like this.
Yeah.
I understand that times change, but baseball's becoming a game now that's being run by a bunch of guys who could be basically hedge fund managers, and they could run quants on Wall Street. Yeah. I mean, you can't – that's going to hurt. They wonder why the sport might be losing some appeal. You got to have characters in the sport. You got to have personality in the sport. You got to have athletes who have some freedom.
Yeah.
They want to manage everything from upstairs now. You can't control the sport that tightly.
Yeah, I think that hey, listen, all information is good information. How you use that information and transform that from on the page to the players, unless the players have really changed from my day, it's very difficult to be able to quantify, understand, and put it into practice. And what I mean, let's just say that in a macro world, this pitcher throws his slider 66% of the time in situations where runners are in scoring position. Well, that gives you a hedge, right? It gives you a chance. But if you faced him 3 days ago and he struck you out on three fastballs, well, that's got to be a factor too. So I just think that I understand the mathematics, analytics, algorithms, all the things that they're trying to use in the game. And I understand in a macro world it really works. You're talking about possession per every 100. Talking about this is if you do this over the course of 162, the process will end up with this. But how do you explain to a team that's lost four in a row and they need to win this game, and eschew the bunt and say, you know, you don't bunt in these situations. You just never do. It doesn't produce. The math says it doesn't produce runs, but your team needs it bad. And occasionally you have to have a feel as a manager that you have to go off the book to do something different to give your team a better chance on that day in that moment, not over the process of 162 games. So that is, I think that's the real interesting thing to me, is that you have front offices having more and more power. You have managers.
Well, now they've run the Socia and the Buck and these guys out of the sport. Now
yeah.
They've
Girardi.
They've run the guys out of the sport.
So you have more and more power by the people that are not on the field. You have inexperienced less power from the people who are on the field, albeit very talented. You have to get together and mix all this stuff and figure out, you know, how to get the job done, because the 3 hours from 7 to 10. I don't care what they tell you, it's the most important thing, right?
And you got to be a little bit of the guy who can walk out on the field and say, here's the game, okay? They throw it, I hit it. They hit it, I catch it. There's still a guy who can do that, who doesn't, you can't tell him where to play, you can't tell him how to play, give him a bat and a glove, he's going to go out there and he's going to do the job because he's just got talent.
Well, you were talking about McNeil before. I don't think if you put McNeil in a computer, it's going to spit out a guy who can really play at a high level.
Well, Pete Rose.
But you watch him, and you go, he's a baseball player.
Right.
And I get asked by people all the time, well, they're all baseball players. If you watch baseball long enough, you know that
there's some guys who are just natural baseball players.
They're just baseball players.
That's it. They don't do anything. They just go out and play.
They just react, see it, and hit it. And I think, you know, that is the most difficult part right now, is just the – all this information, all the managers have to get it to their players in the right situation. And then once 7 to 10 happens, time of game, the manager's got to have a great feel and run a bullpen. He can't run a bullpen now, can't manage.
And it's also not a fun job, I don't think, anymore, managing, because, you know, let's be honest, you're answering to a guy upstairs or a bunch of guys who, A, may never have played or not. That's irrelevant. Whether they played in high school, played in college, didn't play in college, or just went to college and went to some Ivy League, and they're experts on this stuff. Okay, we understand that. But now that guy has him mapped out. He's mapped the game out before the game was played. So why didn't you make this move I wanted you to make in this spot? You know, this was how it was supposed. Well, then what do you need the manager for? Yeah. Let the guy who's doing. So the general manager has usurped all the power in baseball completely.
Yeah,
and he's got a staff of his guys now. He's got his guys, but he's become the power source in baseball.
There's a script-like feel to most games that you can see happening in Major League Baseball. The ironic part is that the people who have the most power, it's still the managers who get fired. You know what I mean? So yeah. That to me is always interesting. Yeah. So the managers have to find a way to not only do that, but protect themselves too, to make sure, because the bottom line will always be the same, Mike. If you win, they overlook a lot of stuff. And if you lose, you're in big trouble.
Well, listen, you played for a guy who was as arrogant and cocky a guy. Let me tell you, he hated me.
I didn't know that.
Davey hated me.
Really?
Because he thought that, how dare you sit there on the air and second-guess me? You can't second-guess me. Or you don't have the right to second. And we used to fight about it all the time. He went crazy on it because he felt like, you know, listen, you just do that. And, you know, the other guys don't do it. Why do you do it? And I just say, well, I don't agree with your move. That's all. I said it before, and I didn't say it afterwards. I said it before. But he got so mad. He and I used to fight like crazy.
Really? Yeah. That's funny. You and I share something, because he wasn't a big fan of mine
either. No, and, you know, and he was a guy who said, I used to go to Earl Weaver.
Yeah.
And, you know, he used to fight with Earl Weaver about it. He thought he was right and Earl was wrong. Right? Well, so he took it, and you probably thought he was wrong, and you were right. So, well, I mean, that's how it was.
I don't
but
know.
But he was one of the first guys to have stats and everything, too, right?
He did. I don't know if it was wrong or right. The two stories about Davey, the one thing he used to throw in my face all the time is he'd say, you know, you're an Ivy League kid. You're 22 years old. I got a kid who's 19 that knows more about pitching than you. I was like, you're absolutely right. But he used to rub that in my face all the time. And it was true. It was true. I couldn't say anything. And the other thing about Davey, we had a game in San Francisco. And I pitched poorly. I ended up winning the game, but I pitched poorly. It was, you know, like a six-inning effort, a lot of walks, a lot of people on base. Very lucky to have somehow won the game or whatever. And I remember Davey used to always kind of needle me in the press. That was his thing. He said, you know, if Darling doesn't throw his curveball, he'll never win in this league. So I took that in, and he and I had we just had a clash. You know, I knew he knew baseball, but I didn't take everything that he told me as gospel. You know, I thought about it. Is it right? Is it wrong for me? And so the next game I pitched against Pittsburgh, I didn't throw one curveball. Because I was like, I'm going to teach him. I don't have to do that. Didn't throw one curveball. Threw a shutout against a bad Pirates team. So I picked my spot. And to the reporters after the game, told you, when he uses his curveball, he's an amazing pitcher. And I didn't throw one the entire game. So that's the kind of battles we used to have, he and I. But he was right. You know, it was difficult at times because young Doc was just so, so good and so bright at such a young age. And I was.
He did a great job of bringing you guys along.
I was a work in progress.
He
for a
really
long time.
Did. He was. He when he came, took you guys as a nurturing. Now let's be honest. You had a lot of talent. You brought You brought in Keith. You brought in Gary Carter.
That's
you
right.
brought in some great players and mixed them with all this young talent that you guys had.
Right.
All you pitchers who were wonderful. Dykstra, who they never even knew how good he was.
That's right.
I mean, they fought it the whole time,
right.
but they didn't want to give him a chance. But he was big in so many big spots.
And clutch too.
Yes. Hojo, who they wanted to force feed, but Ray Knight was always a big cog for you guys.
That's
always
right.
Great leader, right? I mean, one of your really important guys was Ray Knight.
When you think about it, at some point, you could have considered Strawberry the best right fielder in the
Absolutely.
Game, Carter the best catcher, Hernandez
and Gooden the best pitcher,
And Hernandez one of the best first basemen
in
the game because Mattingly was across the
no question
across the hall.
No, and gamers too, great gamers, smart guys, good fielders, good hitters, good players.
Well, you mentioned before earlier, and I think that's the one thing that anyone who played on those '80s teams feels exactly like you feel. So we should have been one of the greatest teams to play in the history of the game. Instead, we were a team that had a great year. That's
yes.
all. And that's disappointing.
Well, 88 was a killer.
88 was
set
a killer.
Set the franchise back forever.
88 was a killer, and I'm one of the biggest reasons. I pitched awful on Game 7. But I think the 86 team is the only team, Mike, that I had ever played on that it was just a type A personalities everywhere. Somehow we came together for that one season, and that was the only team I ever played on that didn't want to just beat people. at times they wanted to embarrass teams.
Yeah,
you know,
and
if it was 5-1, they wanted to beat you 10-1.
And did. You guys were cocky.
Well, the worst.
Yeah, no one liked you guys, right? I mean, no one liked you guys. You guys were really cocky.
Every place we went, we used to, we'd go to Atlanta. They'd have 3,000. We'd go there because they had Coca-Cola there, right? A lot of New York people. We'd have 25, 30,000, whatever. And, we did feel a little bit like P.T. Barnum, that when we came in town, everyone was excited to see us. Very cocky team, lots of fights.
You did something that's very hard to do, though, Ron. You guys took the team, the city away from the Yankees, which is hard to do. You guys had enough personalities
for
that
a
you
short
did it.
Period. Yeah.
You did take the team away, the city away. You guys were the team. There's no question.
It's
and that's hard to do.
Impossible to do here.
It's hard to do.
Yeah, it is.
And you guys did it. It did a great job. It wasn't easy in the Steinbrenner years to do that. And you guys did it.
And
it bothered him because those teams, he wanted to collect them. He wanted to collect everybody he could from those teams because those teams bothered him.
Well, you know how you knew that George was looking across to Queens is that he would mirror a lot of moves. Like Dwight Gooden came up and was great. And he brought up his young 19-year-old, who was the right-hander, Jose. He was great in the 1990 World Series for the Cincinnati Reds. I don't know why I can't think of his name. Great right-hander with a slider.
Rio?
Rio.
Yeah.
So he brought up Rio. Matt, they had unbelievable hitting teams. I mean, they couldn't find enough
pitching. They couldn't pitch. Yeah. And they would trade away good people for pitches and they'd never pitch. They'd never pitch, you know?
Yeah.
That was it. They hit like crazy. They had at one point Ricky Henderson, Mattingly, Jack Clark, and Winfield.
Winfield.
Yeah, hitting 1, 2, 3, 4.
I know, jeez.
I mean, they would score a million runs, but they'd finish second every year. They just couldn't pitch.
I remember in spring training during those times, that was the time that the Yankees and Mets stopped playing each other.
Yep.
Like George didn't even want a part of playing those days. But that's what made it great, you know, that rivalry. And of course, George transformed what you think.
But you
of
guys were
executives.
Able to be that big a team
yeah.
to take over the town. You guys really did. I mean, you had the TV people, you had the city, the people who were like, it was like hip to be a Met fan. It was like, you know, there were people who followed you guys. You guys were like stars. You really were.
It was an interesting period in the city. And I'm glad we're a part of it.
You really were. Yeah. I mean, that was a big, you know, that and winning that year, as crazy as it was, it had to mean a lot to finally win that year, right?
Well, we got, you know, like you said, a lot of bounces went our way.
It's hard to win a World Series.
That's the thing. And I think that when you look at those teams, I hear people say we should have won 3 World Series.
It's hard to win, though.
I think we should have been in 3 World Series.
Right. You never know if you're going to win
winning
them.
Or losing,
right.
Who knows? But right. Luckily, everything bounced right to get one because it would be, I probably wouldn't be on the show if we hadn't won it.
You know, it makes a difference having a ring.
Oh, big time.
It really does. You know, players who don't, in this new era, it's a big deal when you don't have a ring. It really is a big deal.
I think about the shape or arc of your life if you don't have a ring. It changes a lot of stuff. You know, when I hear people all the time say, you know, now it's easy to say because he's on TV all the time through this NCAA stuff and of course, the NBA is, you know, Charles Barkley. Charles Barkley never won.
Never won.
If anyone who watched Charles Barkley play.
Great player. Never won.
One of the great players.
Never won.
And, you know, that hasn't really
Dan
changed.
Marino.
That hasn't really changed. Dan Marino.
Fouts.
I saw Dan Marino in the first Super Bowl. They played against the Redskins at the Rose Bowl. My roommate from college played on that team. He was a rookie. Didn't play a lot, but he played on that team. So I was able to go to the game, and my feeling after that game was the same as everyone. Well, Marino lost his first one. He'll play an eight.
Never played another one. It's amazing. Never did. And you know, it's you just never know. But it does make a difference. It's an empty feeling for those guys. It's a funny thing I always say. The guy who's a really good player, he especially in the NBA, he goes to get his ring. And if he has his ring, he goes to get his money. If he doesn't have his ring, he goes to get his ring. That's how it works.
That's
so,
right. Yeah.
You know, that's what he does. And if he has the ring, then he doesn't worry about it. He goes and gets his contract.
I'm just thinking that there must be times when Charles is in a room and there's probably a lot of ancillary players that weren't that great talking about the championship
sure.
year. Of
like Robert Horry, who's got like 7 or 8
exactly.
of them. You know?
And I'm sure Charles is like, you got to be kidding me. I got to listen to these guys again.
It's probably true. So it makes a big – so you have given it a thought of what it's like if you didn't have a ring, right?
I've given it a lot of thought. Not having a ring, I gave it a thought. If the Mets didn't come back in Game 7, because I did not pitch well in Game 7, you know, what is your station in being a Mets fan? You know, how do you think of a certain guy? And the third thing, and most important, that, you know, I was lucky enough to have a real nice career with the Mets, but I played every year on great teams. And that helps when you're a pitcher. And you're playing on teams who can catch it, they can hit it, they can do a lot of things. You know, you look at a lot of players, say, boy, you know, his career is so-and-so. I know that part of having a great start to my career is that I play with great teams.
So do you think the book, again, is 108 Stitches? Are you making any appearances? Any bookstores?
I'm signing at every bookstore, including the one in Huntington.
Oh, you are?
I am.
That's a good one. That's a very good one. On New York Avenue, they do a great job. I've been there a couple times. Yeah. I've never done a book, but yeah. I did an appearance there with Dog once. And they're very good people. It's on New York Avenue. It's a huge store. They do a great job. They really do.
They really do. And then I'm going to one in New Jersey tonight. But
Bookbinders? That's another good
book
one.
Book review, Bookbinders.
Yep. They're all good ones, yes.
And, but I was thinking, Mike, this is my third book. But for you, really.
Bookends, too, yes.
Bookends.
Yeah, Bookends. Book review is in Huntington. The other one's Bookbinders, right? Yeah.
But I was thinking this is my third book. But for you, Mike, it'll really just need one book.
No, I'm not doing one. You know what? I've been asked, and I actually sat with the publisher last year, and then I said, you know what? Here's what it was. It was so many appearances afterwards. I said, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I just said, you know what? I don't want to make all these appearances. It's like, what do I want to make all these appearances for? And they want so much that, first of all, I don't even know if I'll ever, I would say right now I'll never do one. But you know what? You have a million stories to tell.
Yeah.
It's different for me. I've been on the air so much that, you know what? I might just leave it alone. So, you know what? Do you like doing the process? Do you like doing the books?
I like doing the books. I like that the time I have alone on the road can be spent with something productive. That's what I do. But I think the most difficult part is selling a book. That always, so you
That's
hit,
hard.
You hit the
That's
nail on the head. Maybe you could just do something in Madison Square Garden. Because everyone show up.
Listen, does it ever get tedious? How many games do you do a year now?
I do 100. And
does it ever get tedious on the road?
Tedious on the road, yes. Tedious traveling, yes. But once the game starts, because of the nature of baseball, it's always fun because you just never know. You could come to the ballpark a few seasons ago with a team that's not going so good, and it's June 1st, and a kid like Santana throws a no-hitter. You just never know what's going to happen at the ballpark, and that's still the thrill.
And your team has been together now how many years?
It's our 14th year. Can you believe it?
It's unbelievable.
14.
That's because you guys, and I don't say this. This is it's true. You guys have a really good team. First of all, you got guys who are. You and Keith have your roles down and your chemistry down, and you have a guy who made the transition well. First of all, he's a very smart guy, Gary Cohen. And he was very reluctant to make that change from being a great – he was one of the greatest play-by-play guys of all time on the radio. He was right below Vin Scully. I thought he was number two.
Yeah.
Okay?
Great.
So – and on TV, it's a hard transition to be – because now you got to give it up and be the guy who feeds guys. You got to set up – it's an analyst sport on TV. You got to set guys up. And he's made the transition very well. You guys are a great – listen, you guys have become a great team because you've carved out a nice chemistry and you have your niches. You know what you're doing. You know what Keith's doing. You make Keith the eccentric guy, the whole thing, and it works. So it works really well. It really has.
I know. For Keith, for people who didn't hear this story, about 1 minute before we came on air of our first game, and if you know Keith, you know this is certainly a way he rolls. He looked me in the eye, said, "Listen, I do the hitting, you do the pitching. We'll go back and fight." And they started the countdown for us to come on air, and I was kind of processing. He's like, God, it's so simple. It's perfect.
It's perfect.
Exactly. It takes care of the traffic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Keith talks about all his wacky stuff. You know, and you're the Ivy League pitcher and the whole deal, you know, and it works well, you know.
Sometimes I feel like it's an outstanding broadcast. Sometimes I feel like it's the Larry Sanders Show.
It's good. You know what? It's good. You guys had a good chemistry. It's worked well. So, listen, it either works or doesn't work. That's the bottom line. That's how teams are. They either work or they don't work.
That's right, Mike.
That's it. Well, good luck to you with the book.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Ron Darling back after this.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.